Magnus Heisler.
Yeah, look, it's such a great pleasure to listen to that. Thank you so much. You know, Alec and I, as you said, we've come a long way, and I mean a long way. It's 44 years. And, you know, I've battled to keep pace with Alec at times with these endeavors. I mean, he was the youngest winner of the Sunland Financial Journalism Award at 22, and then he became deputy editor of the Financial Mail at 24, etc. And then he went into APSA as a senior executive and various other ventures, MoneyWeb, listing on the stock exchange. And, of course, there was a bit of a fallout, corporate fallout at MoneyWeb. And lo and behold, we have BizNews. He's done it again. And trying to keep pace with Alec. Then he's in London. Then he's living in the farm with the horses. And now you're in Hermanus. And I was thinking about it this morning. I hope they're going to make you honorary mayor of Hermanus because you're putting it on the map. If not them, at least someone like Pam Golding or Seif, because you're bringing in a lot of money into this town and they're all driving around saying, geez, maybe I should buy a little place here in Hermanus, and maybe I'm going to sell one of my plots in Mauritius and come and camp next to you, Alec. It is so well done. It's been a pleasure to have followed you. But like Alec, you know, I've seen financial journalists for 20 years and had the opportunity to travel the world, went to World Bank conferences. You've been to Davos many, many times. And had a global kind of vision of South Africa and its place in the world, and perhaps more so than other advisors who tend to have been much more insular and focusing only on the South African market. And if you go back to the investment markets and the cycles, the big cycles, you can clearly see that there was and there is times to be in the South African market and to be out of the South African market, and there's no doubt about that. That's the one thing that one has to remember, those big cycles. And the second part, ladies and gentlemen, is that remember, from 1961 until 1998 or thereabouts, it was not possible to take your money offshore and invest it anywhere in the world. And there's a guy, Peter Lynch, that I used to follow, and I read his books. And during the boom time of his management, he made 29% per annum in dollar terms for a very, very long time. And the South Africans were sitting on the sidelines. It was illegal to get money out of the country. So, and Peter, if you distill all his investment advice down to something very simple, apart from anything else, and he do his analysis and his financial comparisons and cycles, etc., he would ask one question: are things getting worse or they're getting better? And this applied to countries, currencies, companies. And remarkably, it worked. And I kind of had that in the back of my mind when I started giving advice, when I eventually started giving advice on a paid-for basis. I always asked myself, are things getting better or worse for South Africa, the currency? And it kind of worked. And since then, from 1998 to about 2002, it was a good time to be in South Africa because you avoided the 1998 Russian crisis, you the Asian crisis, you had the 2001 dot-com bubble that burst. So it was a very nice place to be out of the American markets. The currency was at one stage 13 to the dollar. It came down to 6 or 5.50. We have the Chinese who joined the World Trade Organization. And our resources boomed, our trade balance went through the roof. It was a boom time for South Africa from 2002 to 2010. We had the added benefit of the World Cup coming our way. They were building the Gautrain, the stadiums. They were refurbishing hotels around the country. I mean, our friend David Shapiro even started a construction fund, if you remember. He was so bullish on South Africa. And, you know, John Bickard's value fund, value came through. He was making 30 to 40% year after year. And we made a heck of a lot of money for our clients in that boom time. And again, the cycle was in favor of South Africa, and you were avoiding the United States because their market melted down. And for about 10 years, there was very little growth in the S&P 500. Things, however, started changing. From 2011, 12, 13, I came back from and this is the question that I asked myself on behalf of my clients. And when I started deciding that things are not great, we started recommending offshore investments. But remember, the allowance that time was about 100,000 per person, the single discretionary allowance, and the investment allowance was about 400,000. It was not big money. It was gradually increased, but at the same time, just to give you some context, my wife and I were fortunate enough to be invited to an investment tour of the United States, and the year before that to Japan. But United States in particular, 2014, 2015, it was arranged by Investec at the time, and we paid for the trip. They arranged seminars and meetings with Google, Facebook, Amazon, Tesla. We went to the Tesla factory, Boeing, Wells Fargo, and that little coffee company. Well, I don't know what they make, but what are they called? Starbucks. There we go. That opened my eyes, and everybody was on that tour. Now, we realized, and we listened to these lectures by all these very, very smart guys, half of them ex-South Africans, about what was coming. And that was the beginning of, just to summarize, things were getting very, very better for the American economy. I was impressed by the innovation, the energy, and the money pouring in. Came back to South Africa and started looking around, how can I give my clients access to those funds? And the answer was none. We had no exposure, we had no analysts, we had no road shows on the Magnificent Seven and the technology funds that were taking over the world. In a nutshell, and at the same time, things were getting worse for South Africa. I don't have to repeat this, so I'm going to waste time going through this, we all know. So yeah, you have the Americas or North America, everything is in their favor. South Africa, not going well, was an easy call to make, but I couldn't find the funds in the South African market. In fact, Standard had a technology fund that they closed in 2011 because they said there was no interest in it. So to get exposure for our clients, I reached out to Fidelity and Templeton and said, guys, I need your funds. Can we get access to them? We arranged it through the various platforms. And those clients of ours that got in early have done extremely well, compound growth of 20% plus year after year. And I wrote a piece in Alex's website a while ago. One of my first clients in 2015, when the floodgates opened, you could took out 10 million rand or more, gave us 10 million rand. I mean, that 10 million rand today is 115 million, which was, even if you chose the best fund manager in South Africa, you wouldn't even get to half of that. So South Africans missed out on a phenomenal bull market, mainly because of lack of exposure in South Africa. Secondly, the big institutions in South Africa were not interested or were not qualified or whatever the reason. They kept on saying, there's enough offshore in our funds, don't worry. But there wasn't enough. So we went and created exposure for our clients in those funds. So unfortunately, I started earning the nickname of Dr. Doom or Mr. Doom by advising people to take money offshore. But that's what the facts were telling me. Nothing else. Put my emotions aside or your emotions. And I was branded by a lot of people. And these were the nice words. You must read some of the other stuff. Can't repeat this in front of my daughter who's here for the first time listening to me. It's a great pleasure, my young daughter. So that's what I do, my darling. I don't just sit and read. I do other stuff as well. I mean, even my colleague at MoneyWeb had a go at me and say, you're talking absolute horseshit. This is boom times for South Africa, not what I saw. So, and all my invites to golf days and long lunches dried up from the fund management companies. Anyway, so here we are 10 years later, and I'm just going to skip through. That to me was very important, and I've written a piece on this for Alec. 1st of April 2015, when the exchange allowances were pushed at 1 million rand each, plus the 10, the now the 1 plus 10 million that everybody knows. And I remember going to investment seminars at the time, and fund managers were proudly trying to pretend, no big deal, South Africans are happy with what they got in South Africa. They misread the game. They misread the desire for South Africans to move money offshore for whatever reason, political reasons, financial reasons, personal reasons. And the flood of money has just been enormous. Nobody really knows how much money has gone out. I think the US Reserve Bank knows. But my late friend Mike Sushler guesstimated up until about last year, 1.3 trillion rand has left the country. And that explains many things, including, you know, the poor performance of the local stock markets. So give or take a couple of hundred million, but a huge amount of money has left the country. I would guess that 90% of high net worth individuals have a very large portion of their capital, equity capital, invested in other markets from South Africa. And you can see it in the, and this is one of the effects, and I think most asset managers in South Africa have experienced the same. There's just been no growth in their assets. These are published figures. The AUM, or the assets under management, of Coronation 10 years ago was about 600 billion rand. It's the same today. Now you can look it out yourself. They have not attracted new flows. This was mainly discretionary money that's left. So they don't talk about it, but you will repeat, this will be repeated with most institutional asset managers who have not established offshore operations. Investec was way ahead of, not Investec, well, it was, it's now 91. They had a very big offshore operation, and to a certain extent, Allan Gray with one or two funds. But the rest of the local asset managers, until very recently, totally missed the boat. But only in the last year or two, after they've seen this massive outflow of capital, that they've started forming relationships with big players internationally, you'll find that all the big guys have now formed relationships with either Goldman Sachs or Vanguard or JP Morgan. I see that Ashburton yesterday announced their relationship. But I would like to say that it's almost too late. It's almost too late. And I commented in the chat with Alec a couple of months ago, I think the market is starting to turn. I think, and it's for a lot of people who come to the party late, they're going to say, oh, this offshore investing is rubbish. I've lost money. And I think it could be for a short while the South African market can outperform. Because we come back to, I said, are things getting better or are they getting worse? This is just a slide. I'm not going to waste much time. I just found it in my research. The countries that have grown their wealth the most since 2010, and it ties in with what Donna's going to be doing. Kazakhstan, fastest growing wealth in the world. What did they find? Give a gas. So it could be very much what Alec is saying. So gas could be a very, very big player. The countries that battle the most, we're still positive, but very slight positive growth in USD, 30%. And then you've got four countries, strangely enough, who have lost wealth. Spain, Turkey, Italy, and then, of course, Japan, quite interesting. But that doesn't stop, you know, so one mustn't always correlate growth of the wealth of the country and the performance of the stock market, and I'll make a comment over that a little bit later. Anyway, but in the meantime, as we said earlier, one has to make a comment about the local asset managers. They have enormous marketing machines with enormous marketing power to influence people, and they, by and large, the media laps up what they publish or say. The most classic one to me was 5 years ago, Old Mutual got on stage, going around the country, telling the world, SA market will be the best in the world going forward. And of course, this was on TV, on chat shows, and everybody was happy. But what was the end result? We disagreed with that for various reasons, made ourselves very unpopular. We said we do not agree with that. Now, there is just a comparison of the growth of the Old Mutual Investors Fund, their biggest domestic equity fund. That grew by 4% per annum, as opposed to the NASDAQ 28, S&P at 21, MSCI World at 18. The worrying thing is, I tried to publish these results in the same publication that have a go at me for being negative, and they simply refused. say, no, we're not going to publish it. So there's a lot of pressure, and this is where Business Insider comes in. He will not bow in front of his advertisers. He will publish what is the truth. So, which, again, fantastic. So just to give you an example in the difference of someone who took his money offshore in the same company, not a different company, not for something special, and someone who kept it locally. Today, the offshore person has 3.398, and the local guy has 1.389. Just do the numbers yourself. There's a house and a car, the difference in value created by going offshore, and this applies to anybody who moved their money offshore. But that is the history that is past. Okay. Houston, we have problem. Okay. There we go. All right, I'm not going to waste your time with that. So the bottom line, ladies and gentlemen, the last 10 years, the last 12 years, it's been a dollar story. It's been phenomenal growth offshore. You know, the returns, NASDAQ, MSCI, S&P 500, versus the JSE Aussie in dollar terms has been enormous. Even Coronation started calling it the lost decade. In dollar terms, you made on the JSE 2% per annum, and in S&P 500 was something like 15%. MSCI World was 11%, and the NASDAQ close to 20%. However, and this is not working at the moment, but I'm sure Peter spoke a lot about it. The market is changing. Sai spoke about it. Our market is cheap. U.S. markets are expensive. Maybe, but maybe, this is the time for South Africa. I have no position. I look at the facts as they come in. We will judge them. We will look at the performance. And you will quickly see the trends. And on the first 6 months of this year, the Aussie has outperformed the MSCI World Index, has outperformed even the S&P 500. Again, we need to ask the question, is this real? Is this a repeat of the Ramaphosa story, where we also had that brief honeymoon period and then the reality set in or sat in? But that's where the politics comes into the game. If it changes, if it gets better, we will advise our clients not to bring your money back, but to adjust your local portfolios. And what I mean by that, if you're looking at a portfolio of a client and you've constructed it all across all asset classes, what we have been following is a model, quite simply to summarize, it's been offshore equity for about 75% for most people, and then about the balance 20 to 30% into South African bonds and cash. SA bonds, best performing market in the bonds in the world. So where will you make the adjustments? So that's where the advisor has to come in and plan. You make the adjustment on the local side. You will reduce the bond exposure and increase more on the equity side. So it's very nice to be looking at local portfolios that are suddenly, property is one example, 361 that Sy Jacobs runs for us, to see some nice returns. So there might be a little change, but to put your hat on it and bank everything on it, I would not do that. Then just a couple of comments before I finished. Alec, while you were interrogating Sy and have about the collapse about world markets and what you can do and where you can hide, if someone asks me, can the Wall Street drop by 30 or 50%? My answer normally is, yes, it can. But I just don't know when. And that's your big problem. You have so many people warning and forecasting, and it doesn't happen. And if you're going to react every time someone makes a bold forecast, you will go crazy. You will probably lose all track of your investments. CGT will hit you. So there are other ways to protect your capital. But if you cannot stomach a 30% decline in world markets, which happens on average about twice every 10 years, going back 100 years, you should not be in the stock market then your advisor is not doing his job. You should be in a different kind of portfolio. And then just to end off, Alec, I'm running ahead of time. Who in this audience has got money invested in Japan? Who in this audience has got money invested in India? Nobody. There we go. Did you know, and I even didn't know that, but I suspected that a while ago. I started looking at the performance of Japan after Buffett made some comments, but we've been using Japan as one of our funds. Though the last 20 years, starting points are very important. Last bit for the end. The two best performing stock markets in the world has been India and Japan. Now, why don't you have money in India and Japan? Think about it. You decide why not. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen.
It's because you, with your discussion, you began, you explained to us the cycle that it was a good time to be invested in South Africa. Then there was a cycle when it was a good time to be invested in the US. We spoke off air here about John Maynard Keynes saying, when the facts change, I change my opinion. What do you do, sir?
Yeah.
So what are you doing right now? Is the cycle turning?
Well, it's too early to tell. You know, as Mao Zedong said when they asked him, what do you think about the French Revolution? And he said, it's too soon to tell. It's only 200 years. So it's too soon to tell. The signs are there that the SA market is starting to attract some attention. The money's not flowing in yet. There's been still a negative outflow of bonds and equities. So it's local buying at the moment. It's local buying. It's not foreign buying. I think it's guys like Sai who are moving money to this side and other fund managers. So that's the one thing that I look at on a monthly basis. Are the foreigners buying, yes or no? At the moment, they're not buying. It's not true. I looked at the stats yesterday. Still negative last month. So if they start buying and start buying on a 3, 4, 5 months, to me, that'll be a sign they're coming to the party. So that hasn't happened yet. So it's a bit of local portfolios. There is nice interest in the local funds, but the big signs are not there yet. Secondly, we need to see an uplift in economic growth, and both Sai and Sean have spoke about our poor growth. And then thirdly, we need to look at the GNU, and I know you've had your political speakers. There's still a lot of uncertainty. I don't think that the foreigners will come in mass with large amounts of capital until they really trust what they see in the GNU. There are too many stumbling blocks. You've got the Bella legislation, the National Health Insurance legislation. There could be a political squabble, split, whatever. And that's still the risks lingering there. So for the time being, for new money, not existing portfolios, if you come to me tomorrow with some new money, and depending on what your risk tolerance is, I would maybe hold back on going money offshore, probably put it into one of the local funds. There's a bit of momentum, but it's a purely strategic decision. A tactical decision in the short term. Longer term, it's still the same. Offshore is my preferred choice. But there is money to be made in the local market. How long? That I don't know.
Maybe just picking up from something that I always ask Rob Herzog, because he said South Africa is not investable. Is South Africa investable then?
Yes, of course it is. There's still money to be made in South Africa, whether it's making timeous decisions on the stock market based on valuation. Property, I've tweeted once or twice. My wife and I bought two properties in the Western Cape. We bought in Tiger Valley. We bought in Rehoboth and Paarl, which is a fantastic growth area. So there still is money to be made in property. And I think when the interest rate cycle comes down, I would not buy property for speculative purposes in an ANC-controlled province. That I wouldn't do, and I've been saying that for a long time. It's only the Western Cape. So yeah, I put some money into the local market.
But that's a big story, Magnus. You've been pretty negative but now you're buying property, which is the biggest vote of confidence one could possibly have, in because it is so long term and because the trading costs are so high.
Correct. I mean, it's, and I think, I don't know why it angered a lot of people, and especially journalists and media bosses, you know, disloyalty, unpatriotic. I said, you guys don't pay me. My clients pay me. My decisions are based on facts, and I can show you my facts. The media doesn't publish half of what's happened in South Africa the last 10 years for various reasons. But the facts are changing. There is a little bit of optimism coming in. There is still, and there has been for the last 10 to 12 years, even longer, a very dramatic migration of wealthier people from the north to the south, to Hermanus, Paarl, Franschhoek, Cape. Those property prices have done very, very well. So, and lastly, you know, with exchange control, you can't take all your money out of the country. It's still a schlep and an application form. So there, what do you do with the balance of your capital? And I like property, believe it or not. And I still should wear my Springbok jersey today, but I didn't. Oops, All Blacks. I'm sorry. You know, so this whole story that I'm negative and you know, I love the country. All my children are in the country. My grandkids are in the country. But, you know, I am a global citizen as well. And I've always said that I do not want to be beholden to only one country, because remember, the relaxation of foreign exchange rules means that there are still rules and they can introduce them tomorrow. And I think we dodged the bullet with the election. And I don't know what Francis, how he would answer that question, that there was a small chance that it could have gone wrong and that the MK AEFF alliance got into power. Then all the bets would have been off as far as investments are concerned. So that political risk has not disappeared from South Africa. It's not gone. It's better. But there's always that worry about what happens in the next election, depending who gets into power, you know. So, but for the next 5 years, I think we're okay.
Are we getting worse or are we getting better, to use your primary question?
The mood is improved. Who spoke about Operation Bulandlela? I can't remember, Sy Jacobs. That behind the scenes is starting to do a lot of good work. I mean, we've seen there's some benefits in Eskom. Looks like the things are moving in terms of the railways. But the two biggest issues for me as a South African living here, and I have this discussion with my wife the other day, I said to her, darling, doesn't matter what we do, if we don't solve the unemployment problem and we don't solve crime, South Africa will not be investable in the long term. Because both you and Sean referred to Dr. Simon Murray. I remember an interview with Simon Murray as a journalist still, and I asked him, what is the first thing that you look at when you invest in any country in the world? And he immediately said, law and order, protection of property rights. And of course, we're failing big time on law and order in most parts of the country. So yes, it's getting better, but it's too soon to tell.
It's an interesting point. We will have Ian Cameron at our conference in March, and Neil De Beer, who's in the audience, he's going to be talking in March as well, and they'll be able to give us good insights into that. But certainly the feedback we're getting is that the new police minister is a massive improvement on the last police minister.
That wasn't too difficult.
Shut up. I couldn't resist. But the reality is, getting back to your Peter Lynch question, when you even look at things like crime, is it getting worse or is it getting better?
Well, I'm not an expert on crime. I read what you read about crime and maybe some, you know, some podcasts. It doesn't look like it's improving. But one gets the moving, the young Cameron guy, I think he's starting to shake the tree a little bit there, that could be this beginning of the improvement. So I'm saying it's still early days. You know, as I said, I'm very pleased with the outcome. There's a better mood. Rugby is helping. But rugby doesn't determine where stock markets go and capital goes. And I still think there's a tremendous amount of capital pent up in South Africa waiting to explode. You know, that's the nature of a businessman, a capitalist. Doesn't like sitting with capital in the bank, earning 8%. There's a heck of a mountain of money sitting there. We just need the triggers. And as I said, I'm more optimistic now than I was 6 months ago. Plus, and I think this point has been made, world markets are on the expensive side, and one needs to be looking at other parts in the world like India, Japan, to answer the question of people, well, what if Wall Street blows up? I would, and a lot of our clients have a very nice exposure to Japan, which incidentally has beaten the S&P 500 the last 5 years. Nobody knows about it. The media doesn't talk about it. So the media is very USA focused in terms of market commentary, maybe a bit in London. But the big markets today, of course, is the USA. And the one slide that I had here, which I found very, very interesting, ladies and gentlemen, in the year 1900, and I got this from the Visual Capitalist this week, in the year 1900, that was barely 13 years after gold was discovered, the JSE constituted 3.5% of world market cap. 3.5%. The biggest was London, of course, with 25%, and the UK and the US was about 12%. Of course, 120 years later, it's changed dramatically. The USA is now 60% of the world. UK is now down to about 6%, and South Africa, unfortunately, mainly due to the decline in our economy and the gold mining industry, is 0.5%. So that just tells you a story once again. The decision to invest locally or offshore is not a binary one, offshore, onshore. Once you go offshore, you've got the whole big world to go and look for wealth opportunities. Countries like Argentina, very exciting stuff happening there. India probably would be my one advice for you to go and have a look at or talk to your advisor and say, listen, why am I not in India? It's outperforming the S&P 500. The same with Japan. I mean, after we came back from a trip to Japan, we had a session at the Japanese Central Bank. I came back and I said to my wife, Susie, we like this. Apart from the sushi, we also like the stock markets. And that has done exceedingly well, but there's no coverage. So that's why it's nice to be an independent advisor, because you could understand the advice business in South Africa. 70 to 80% is dominated by the big players. They will sell and market the products that they have in stock. It's like a Checkers or a Pick and Pay. They're going to promote what they can sell to you. The independent guys, like ourselves, we can go and find the best product for our clients if we think it's appropriate for our clients. There's nobody up there is telling me, hey, you got to do this or you got to do that. We're going to do it for our clients because ultimately they're the guys that pay us. So we've had happy hunting grounds in India, Japan. What's also been quite nice, European pharmaceutical stocks, the granolas. I'm sure you've heard of the granolas. There are 11 European stocks, AstraZeneca, Nestle, etc. They make up the name granola. They also outperform the S&P 500. So that's just, there's more to stock markets than just SA America. There's a lot of hidden treasures. Jim Rogers wrote a book many years ago, The Investment Biker. He became very well known for doing exactly that. He went out of mainstream and he went looking for investment opportunities. And I think in that book, he tells a story or he uses a concept of the parking lot economists. They only look for facts which everybody can see. And he uses the analogy of a drunkard. This guy was walking in a parking lot late at night, and he found this guy under this lamp on his knees. And he says, what are you doing? He says, I'm looking for my car keys. And I said, okay, I'll help you look. And after 10 minutes, he says, no, I can't find the keys. He says, are you sure you lost them here? He says, no, I lost them there in the dark. So, and you know, that's sometimes you just got to think out of the box in terms of investment. Sometimes it's what they're not right about. And out of left of field, you get some very investment opportunities. But the big companies, by and large, which are mainly marketing companies, they will not go and promote a product which they don't have in stock. And I think it's the role of investment advisors like us to go and find stuff, go meet with them. And then, you introduced me to Sean Pichet, and he's been a fantastic fund manager for our clients. But when I first started talking about Ranmore, everybody said, these idiots. That kind of attitude. We don't know them. And there's a tense thing in South Africa. We follow a lot of investors and follow brand-name investing. Brand-name investing. They love the brand they invest, but they don't look at the fundamentals. And that's like Old Mutual. It doesn't sometimes, make you money. And so we do not follow brand-name investing.
You know, in the early years when I went to Berkshire Hathaway, Warren Buffett used to have a Sunday afternoon press conference, and there were only 30 people who were invited to it. And if you go to the Berkshire Hathaway AGM, there are 40,000 people there. People queue up from early in the morning to get to a microphone to ask Warren and Charlie, the late Charlie Munger, a question.
Yeah.
At the press conference, we each had the opportunity, all 30 of us, to ask a question of Warren and Charlie. And some of the information that came out from that was, it was worth me getting on a plane and flying for 26 hours to go to the AGM every year. Not for the AGM, but for that press conference. He stopped them when he turned 80, unfortunately. So I only got to 4 or 5. But I remember it so clearly, him saying to us, to this assembled group of 30 journalists, "You guys aren't going to listen to this because you're not going to be allowed to print this. But if you are a know-nothing investor," and that is, somebody asked him, "Where would you put your wife's money?" He said, "If you are a know-nothing investor, you should only be investing in index funds because they're cheap."
Yeah.
"Most of the investments that you will be pushing in your publications are from marketing machines, which are asset management companies, the ones that you were talking about." Do you think the penny is dropping? You've been saying this for many, many years here in South Africa, that there is it's almost like we have this predilection to go with Old Mutual, to use as an example, Coronation 91, because they are superior marketing machines. You've said that, and we've said it at Business to our cost, I can tell you. We had a huge advertising campaign, which never came our way, from one of them, just the other day, in fact, yesterday. So I'm thinking about it a little bit, but they've switched that money elsewhere because they will not support the independent voice. From your perspective, really two things. Has it cost you? And secondly, is the penny starting to drop amongst South Africans that maybe what Warren Buffett said about them being marketing machines is true?
I think the sophisticated investor in South Africa has seen through that story. They're now asking the right questions. They look at costs and they look at performance. And the old days that, because you live in Bellville and you speak Afrikaans, you have to invest with Sanlam. And if you live in Rondebosch, you've got to invest with Old Mutual. Those days are changing. I found that clients are far more informed through mediums like you, and they're walking with articles. You see what Alec Ock says, and then, I've got to try and defend you. But they are becoming smarter. But, the middle class who have limited knowledge of markets, there's an old saying that he or she or they or it or when or is ignorant will never know they're being abused. And that I've seen in my career as a journalist, first of all. If you don't know what questions to ask, you never get the answer that you should be hearing. People are now asking the right questions about fees, performance, etc., etc.
Well, I'm really looking forward to the impact that we can make. We're launching, those of you who are of a certain age will remember that I started Business Radio in South Africa in 1997, and we're relaunching that on Monday. So watch out for it, 5 o'clock on Monday. We will have our BizNews Briefing, it's called, where we'll be coming back live to try and unpack and explain the issues, like with Sean a little earlier. We won't be confusing people. We'll be unconfusing people so that they can actually make those decisions.
Well, I think that's fantastic, because if you look at the there's this huge generational transfer of wealth going to happen in the next 10 to 20 years. As the wealthier older people start dying off, they're going to be transferring assets to younger people, and they're going to inherit a lot of money in many respects. And secondly, there's a massive retirement wave coming where there's a huge amount of capital sitting, and those people will be retiring out of pension funds, getting, you know, large amounts of money. And that's normally where the trouble starts. So the more education you can do, Alec, and fantastic. Well done for you.
Well, unlike in the past, we've now got our own distribution channels, which does make it a lot easier.
It does. Of course, yeah.
Linda Biggs is asking you, Magnus, if one is already invested offshore in US big caps, etc., how should one adjust one's offshore portfolio?
Probably not do anything. If you have it always depends on so many factors. That's why I was quite intrigued with the debate you were having with Cy and Sean about what about stock markets dropping and this and that. And those fears are always there. And I'm not being facetious when I say markets will drop 30%. I just don't know when. If you are, it's a funny strategy that I've been following for 30 years and for my clients and all our advisors. If the clients, we first of all determine a client's tolerance to risk. Then we determine risk profile, and they're two different things, because we do a psychometric test of a client. And we, you know, most clients say, no, I'm fine with the volatility. I'm good. I'm with, you know, the first downturn in the market, they'll be on the phone. What are we doing? And they panic and they make mistakes. They should not have been in that fund if that is their reaction. So if you have been assessed correctly and the client knows at some time and he's comfortable with the fact that there could be a downturn of 20-25%, then it's fine. They know it and their portfolio is structured correctly. But if someone has 100% of his or her capital in the MSCI 500, the S&P 500, or the NASDAQ, that is the wrong advice. That is high risk, because it's extremely volatile. So volatility, risk, tolerance, etc., all comes into play. That a fund manager never has to worry about that. Fund manager has to worry about two things, and it's an old saying in the industry, is to get funds and to keep funds. When they're doing well, they pull in the money. And when they're not doing well, is to keep the guys there, saying things will turn, don't sell now, long term. The advisor is a totally different role. Now, I know that the phrase Omberg reckons financial advisors are worse than second-hand car salesmen, but that's not true anymore. The level of complexity that we deal with today, especially, and I must make this point, our practice in the last 5 years, 10 years, ladies and gentlemen, has exploded in complexity. Why? Huge amount of money has gone offshore. Our clients, some are moving offshore. Their kids are moving offshore. So suddenly you have got to be an expert on SA tax, overseas tax, SA trusts, offshore tax, trusts, CITES, inheritance. It's an absolute minefield. And those advisory companies who have not upskilled themselves will lose out, because we're living in a global world. And it's a reflection of our society, where on average, you know, many high net worth South Africans have kids in England, Australia, Canada. What happens now when the money is sitting in Jersey and they pass away? The inheritance laws, the taxation laws, it's a nightmare, an absolute nightmare. And we had to employ very quickly very smart people to answer those questions. And it's going to become increasingly so. So if you don't have a global advisory business today in South Africa, you will not survive.
Fascinating how things do change, and how the world is becoming so much smaller, and the levels of complexity that come with it. Peter Jenkins wants to know, How would you advise on getting exposure to those Indian and Japanese markets?
Well, Orbis runs a very good global Japan equity fund. It's a very large fund, fantastic track record. So there's a fund I'm not giving advice, I should stress. It's there. There are some ETFs that track the Japanese market, but you've got to find the right platform. Franklin Templeton, or just Franklin as they call them now, runs a very good India fund. There's some ETFs that you can use to get involved in India. So there are various instruments, but the ones that we use is the Orbis Global Equity. That we've been using for a very long time. And then the India from Franklin more recently. But there are other options, but they're not always available on the platforms that South Africans tend to use.
The one that we used to have in the Shift portfolio is iShares Japanese. So there are plenty of ETFs there if you're on the Shift portfolio, for instance. Faree wanted to know, I don't know if it's first name Faree or surname Faree, but Faree, what is your view on passive versus active investment funds, especially given the low percentage of active fund managers that actually beat the market?
From an advisory perspective, there's no such thing as passive investing. Think about it. What is passive investing? It's the instrument that's passive, but the choice and the asset allocation is never passive. It changes all the time. So many people make the mistake, oh, I'm just going to buy the S&P 500. As I said earlier in my talk, for 10 years it underperformed world markets because it started from a very high point. The valuations were very high. Who says it can't happen again? So yes, even a passive investor there's no such thing as passive investing. Unless you buy a certain portfolio and there's major risks attached to that. So the advisor uses passive instruments to create a portfolio depending on the client's portfolio, and that changes over time. So I think you get what I'm saying. Yes.
But this big argument of active managers and, you know, don't forget about the active managers, just put it into index funds. Where do you stand on that argument?
You know, again, it depends who writes the article and who promotes. Yes, there's been a big move, mainly because of costs. But strangely enough, many of our funds, our active managers like Ranmore, is outperforming the various indices. I'm also more comfortable, and just another point, why we use Sean, we agree to put money into his funds if he talks to us on a regular basis. I need to know what's happening inside the fund. Many of the big fund managers will never talk to you, and you never know what's happening in the box. Now, I can pick up the phone or Teams and have a meeting and say, Sean, what are you guys doing? And right now, as he tried to explain, they very underweight the American market, overweight other regions. And we're very comfortable with that, but we know what's in his box. And the same applies to the Orbis Japan Fund. That's outperformed all the indices, believe it or not, by a substantial margin. So there's a little bit of a... I don't want to call it a lie, but the passive industries are trying to say, yeah, but on average, many, many active managers are underperforming. What they're not saying is the 20% who are outperforming, and you just have to go and find them. And we do find them. You just go and search. You just do some homework. So it's quite easy to beat, in my opinion, if you know or someone who knows what they're doing.
And I think that... not just Sean, but Piet Viljoen is showing that as well. Cy Jacobs is really showing that and has been showing it for many, many years. So there are, it's like anything. If you're going to get a plumber, don't get a guy who doesn't know what he's doing. You get somebody who comes recommended, you can see his work, etc. It's the same with investing. You find the people who are outperformers because you can understand that they have a superior process or whatever the case might be. Renee Kilner, have you ever considered investment advice relating to traditional marriages in South Africa?
I thought all marriages were traditional. I don't get the question. I mean, is three wives not enough for me?
Yes, Jacob. Magnus, we're coming to the end of the day's proceedings. I know you had a medical emergency this morning, but you're feeling better now, so all good. You were here this afternoon. There was quite a strong theme of danger overseas, danger in America. South Africa's been through the ringer for so long. And you correctly have said, stay away from this crazy place. But now it's the investments are starting to appeal, certainly to people who, a little bit like when Frans Grenier 5 years ago, was when he, and I mentioned this earlier this morning, that when we had coffee maybe 10 years ago, I just couldn't take it anymore. He was so negative.
I recall, yeah.
And now he's the opposite.
I think he's driven by facts. The same as me. I mean, I hope it's the start of a period of recovery, because if you actually look at the last 10 to 12 years, the middle class in South Africa has almost been wiped out, and you see it in all kinds of economic indicators. The other day I read one of the food companies was saying even the sales of Eat Some More biscuits are down because people don't have disposable income. So you look at after 10 to 12 years of very stagnant and declining residential property values, and we've spoken about that with the exclusion of Western Cape, pension funds on average not beating inflation by much, your big traditional large asset managers beating inflation by 1 or 2, plus the currency dropping from 11 to 12 to 19, combine that with a sharp spike in the dollar inflation as a result of COVID, and the purchasing power of the average South African has plummeted. And you see it in car sales, you see it in sales of luxury goods, of watches. There's just no more money in the system. So it comes at a very good time for the South African economy, the average South African, whose the tanks are empty. So is it a major upturn? It's too soon to tell, but we for the first time in 12 years, I'm whispering, it's getting a little better. I'm feeling more confident. Alec is feeling more confident. My friends are feeling more confident. And you speak to numerous people. Five years ago, every guy said to you, get the hell out of Dodge. You know, it's all over. Even Cuban Naidu a while ago said, in 2022, we were on the brink in terms of IMF defaults and reneging on our debt. So even he admitted we came very close. So we are owed a decade of slowly building our wealth again in a country. And as I said, I put some money in, bought some more property, we changed some of our local portfolios. You know, I don't want to leave the country if I don't have to, but, you know, investments are different. But I think if Ramaphosa and the GNU does a couple of things right, I think we could have a nice period of increased prosperity.
And perhaps from my side, the big theme that I've got out of this is there are some very clear trends. Yeah. After a certain age, you shouldn't be using technology. There are some very, very clear trends that we can take with us. And we have a propensity as human beings, as part of the human condition, to get distracted, to get caught up in emotion, to get sucked into headlines. And we will try at BizNews to give you a balanced view, always. We just don't know. We don't know what we don't know, and we certainly don't know the future. But what we do know is that there has been a massive change from just about every front in our society over the past 7 years. I would remind you that in 2017, the Zuma dynasty was beaten by less than 24 votes out of 4,000. I would remind you of that fact. Had that happened differently, we would be sitting in a very different country. I would remind you, too, that the ANC's hegemony, what is it?
Hegemony.
Okay, by a donkey. That's what I'm working at. The ANC's dominance has gone from 57% to 40%. Who would have thought of that? We have a society, a country created for coalition governing. And for the first time, we can put that to the test. Let us hope that we have matured as a political society in the way that the voting public have matured. Because I remember talking, who's that guy from CNN who's out there? You know the guy I'm talking to? No, not Kramer. The Richard Quest. Richard Quest was in South Africa. We had an interview and he said, and we were talking, it was in the middle of load shedding. He couldn't talk to us because its lights were off, and eventually he was talking on his battery and it was really crazy. He was coming here to see whether it was a good place to ask tourists to come to. He was sitting in Cape Town with us. And we spoke about the election, and he rightly said, this is an election which will determine the future of South Africa. From his perspective, he's a guy that millions of people watch. He said that he was unsure that the South African democracy had matured sufficiently to get to a point where it would make the changes that were required. Well, I would suggest to you that the results of the election show we have matured as a democracy and got to the place where the voting public have told us, we don't want the crap that we've just been through. We want you guys to work together. And if you don't work together, we will punish you. And there are certain politicians who presumably will learn that lesson the hard way. But hopefully we've got sufficient maturity that we will surprise the Richard Quests of the world, and we will surprise even ourselves in the way that Rossi has surprised the world. Remember, we haven't beaten the All Blacks four times in a row since 1949. That's got to say something. Magnus Haystack, members of the tribe, thank you for being here today. It's been such a privilege to have this conference, the first investment conference, here in Hermanus. We will have another one same time next year as an update. We will be gathering again in March, but it's not goodbye because we're off to the golf club now to go and have pizzas, and there will be a fireside chat with an American entrepreneur, South African entrepreneur from America called Brian Smith. It'll be very interesting to get an understanding of how the technology world is going, how the VC venture capital world is going. And it's also an opportunity to go there and go and meet new people then and make new friends, which is really the thrust of these events. So thank you for coming. Magnus, as always, it's been great to finish with you.